Thank you for downloading this Great Lives podcast from BBC Radio 4. For more information and details of other podcasts, just visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
The year is 1822. For the first time in nearly two centuries, a reigning British monarch is visiting Scotland. It's George IV, only 2 years on the throne, obese and stinking of cherry brandy. The royal yacht is tugged by steamboat into the port of Leith near Edinburgh. Thousands turn out to see him. The royal jamboree lasts a fortnight. There are processions, dinners, gatherings of the clans. He kisses hundreds of women. All gentlemen have been ordered to wear kilts, even though Lowlanders would never normally wear Highland dress. And who was the man choreographing the event? The subject of this week's programme, Sir Walter Scott, the man who, some would argue, invented Scottishness. My guest this week is himself a Scot, Rory Stewart, MP, not a Highlander though, but a man of the Borders. He represents an English constituency, Penrith and the Borders. Rory, English people have an idea of the Highlands and of Edinburgh and of Glasgow, but the Scottish Borders are a little bit hazy to a lot of us. Scott himself was from the Borders. Give us a sort of word picture of the area, of the region.
Well, this is one of the extraordinary things that Scott achieves, is to make people see the Borders. What he uncovers is something that's very, very difficult for anyone to get their head around, which is 450 years, the most extraordinary savage warfare by clans who don't have Mac tied to the front of their name, but people called Scott or Maxwell or Johnson or Hume or Armstrong or Elliot, who rampage back and forth between Cumbria, which I now represent, and strange remote castles like Liddesdale, men with their own type of law, their own type of honour, and who barely have a house between them because they're raiding each other so continually.
Were you born and brought up there?
No, I'm really from slightly higher up in Scotland. So I'm from another area that Scott was obsessed with, which is where the Lowlands meets the Highlands. So my father's house is in Perthshire, and that's where my family's from. So I play that same game that you've just been teasing George IV for doing. I spend a lot of time, or did when I was a child, strutting around in a kilt, being a Highlander without quite
but
being
not,
in the
not
Highlands.
Not stinking of cherry brandy.
I hope not.
We're about to immerse ourselves in a once lionised author who, for an astonishing number of our countrymen, is today only a name. So, by way of fanfare, Rory, give me a short opening blast, your case for this early 19th century novelist.
I think he teaches us what the British landscape is. He's the first person to open it up. And he doesn't do it in a bland, homogenous fashion. Central to him is the distinction between Scotland and England, between the Scottish landscape and the English landscape. He's a man who's very, very proud to be Scottish, but is also not a man who wants an independent Scotland. So he's very contemporary in that sense. He shows another way of being Scottish, which is proud of being Scottish, can even be contemptuous of the English without wanting to break up the United Kingdom. But most importantly of all, he brings history into the landscape. He is able, looking around from the top of the Eildon Hills, to see not just a modern dry stone wall, but a scrap of oral history or a ballad he's picked up from a shepherd, a Pictish stone, a fragment of a Roman camp, and wind it all together into something that has meaning, that has identity.
With us in the studio is Stuart Kelly, author of Scotland, The Man Who Invented a Nation. Stuart, spell out the claim here. Scotland obviously existed before Sir Walter Scott, so in what sense did he invent the nation?
I think because he created a version of Scotland which was a global product. Of course, Scotland existed before Scott wrote Waverley, but the rest of the world didn't really have an image of Scotland that it could understand and use. And the most important thing about Scott in some ways is that he wasn't just speaking to the Scots. He was speaking to the English, he was speaking to the Americans. He was the first author whose reputation was worldwide rather than merely a sort of local phenomenon.
In a sense, he marketed Scotland, although...
Shamelessly.
And intentionally, do you think he set out to do just that?
Yes. His major first work is a long anthology of traditional poems called The Minstrelsy of the Scottish Border. And he's adamant about what this book has to do. He says it will record the traditional poetry of Scotland, which day by day is melting into that of her sister and ally England. So it was a kind of cultural salvage project to say, you know, in the face of a new British identity, that instead of having some homogenous identity, we would have a specific Scottish identity and a specific English identity, and to kind of retain that sense of difference.
He's also somebody who understands the medieval and who creates that sympathy for the medieval, which is then so important for what happens in Victorian Britain. The extraordinary breadth of imagination and learning and confidence you really needed to represent a different tradition, both the medieval tradition, but also the wildness, the banditry, the savagery of the Borders, as something that's even worthy of note or interest.
As you speak with a slight glint in your eye about wildness, savagery and banditry, it can't but strike us that your own background and career so far have elements of Scott's imaginative landscape in them. You packed a huge amount in so far: Afghanistan, Iraq. Where have you been and what have you done? Give us it in a nutshell.
I was briefly in the army in the Black Watch, a Scottish regiment, and then I joined the Foreign Office and was in Indonesia and Yugoslavia. I spent 2 years walking across Asia. So I walked across Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India and Nepal.
Just walking?
Just walking, not getting in any cars or planes, just walking.
Walking must teach you an awful lot about the places. Well, you entitled one of your books, The Places in Between, The People in Between. You've walked across Afghanistan as well, haven't you?
Yes, I walked across Afghanistan, and that was also something that makes me, I suppose, think of Scott, because what you pick up there, and that I felt very strongly, and I feel actually now as a Member of Parliament in the Borders, is the sense of very, very different cultures. For example, in Afghanistan, the sense of honour, and what is positive about that and negative about that. Scott has a wonderful short story called The Drovers, where he talks about Highland honour, and in fact what happens is there's an argument between an English and a Scottish friend, and the Scottish friend stabs the Englishman because he feels his honour has been offended. And there's an extraordinary moment at the end when the judge is trying to explain this and trying to explain that time's moved on, of course the man needs to be prosecuted for murder, but still there's something splendid about this sense of pride, this sense of honour.
Here's the problem, though, and we really can't go any further without voicing it. Nobody reads Scott any longer. He took the world by storm. His novels were sensational successes. He made a fortune out of them. He was a household name. But I've tried to read Scott. I tried to read Waverley the other day for preparation for this programme. And it was so turgid. Why didn't he? What were you want to say? Waverley was a good walker. Why do you have to say our hero was a tolerable pedestrian? I just couldn't take any more of it after 20 or 30 pages. Why? I won't say why has he so fallen out of favour. I can see why he has. How is it that he was ever quite so widely and popularly read?
Well, I mean, his popularity was astonishing. There is just nobody, not even J.K. Rowling, gets close to the kind of dissemination that Scott achieved. And the Scott Monument in Edinburgh is the largest monument to any author on the planet, and says at the bottom of it that the only person who can be compared to is Shakespeare. For the original readers, they saw something very Shakespearean in the idea of mixing together comedy and tragedy and history all within one work. If you read him as a kind of extension of the 18th century, as the heir to writers like Laurence Sterne and Henry Fielding, the opening of Waverley is actually one of my favourite parts, because it's so witty and strange. And, you know, nobody would begin a novel in the period saying, I wonder what I'll call this novel. There's something, I mean, it's a dread word, but there's something postmodern about his kind of wit and humour. And when I did the book on Scott, one thing I really wanted to stress was, if you look at his prefaces to the novels, I mean, the novels themselves are wonderful and thrilling, but in the prefaces, there is something truly strange. The preface to The Betrothed involves Scott imagining a steam-powered novel-writing engine. Now, nobody else would have come up with that.
And Matthew, I mean, I think the partial answer to your question is that he is so extraordinary in his imagination, his tolerance, breadth, sympathy. The problem is really his prose and the way he writes. And he has a strange, pompous style. And one of the problems is he's writing far too much. He's churning out maybe 6,000, 7,000 words a day while working as a sheriff and planting trees and receiving endless visitors. It's just too quick. But the great stuff, where you really see his humour and his brain, and we really sympathise with him, is in his journals. So you look at his journals and he'll say things like, "I hate funerals. Always did. There's such a mixture of mummery with real grief. The actual mourner, perhaps, heartbroken, and the rest making solemn faces, whispering observations on the weather and public news, and here and there a greedy fellow enjoying the cake and wine." Now, that could almost be Matthew Paris.
If only he had written like that, though. And he didn't. I mean, are you, by coming on this programme and championing the man, are you seriously suggesting that we should read Scott now?
I think you should read Waverley. I'd encourage you to
have another go.
Push on with Waverley. His ability to imagine what Highland life was like 60 years before his birth. He opens, you'll remember, with Waverley, once he's left home, is turning up to visit his first Scottish house, and he's coming through a village. And it's really one of the great descriptions of the developing world. There are naked children lying in the street. There are yapping dogs all the way around chasing the horses. There's a strange mixture of indolence, lassitude, everybody giving up, but also an extraordinary sense of dignity and humour and toughness in these people. And the way in which he moves between those registers, I think you need to just give yourself a bit more time.
Is he an honest writer?
I think he is an honest writer. It's sort of muffled in pompous prose. But there are other things that, if I try to encourage you to read more Scott, I'd push you towards. I think it's worth looking also at some of his great narrative poems. So Lay of the Last Minstrel, for example.
One thing about the poetry which is very striking is he started using place names at a time when most landscape poetry would have absolutely avoided the place name as being too local, too specific.
You can use him as a tourist guidebook, and suddenly the everyday places around you and the borders suddenly take on a whole new light. Instead of sort of glumly walking past the 24-hour Tesco's and Gala Shields, suddenly you're aware of the Abbey of Melrose, you're aware of the Roman camp on the Eildon Hills, you begin to get a sense of Scott of Buccleuch charging off to rescue Kinmont Willie Armstrong from Carlisle.
Let's find out a little bit about where he came from. A rich family?
Well, his family is based in Edinburgh, and Scott's childhood almost encapsulates the problems of the man. Most of his mother's side of the family were in the medical profession and were professors of medicine at Edinburgh University. His father was a lawyer. Going back a generation, they were farmers. And the young Scott developed what we think was probably polio. And he was treated in two very opposite ways. From his sort of mother's side of the family, in the new town of Edinburgh, when it really was a new town, they put a galvanic generator against his leg and gave him electric shocks. And this was cutting-edge science, and that didn't work, obviously. So they sent him down to the borders, to Smalham Tower, where the family still farmed, and he had his leg wrapped in the caul of a lamb, which was a traditional folk remedy. And I think in the two ways that they try to treat him, you see the two things that go right the way through his life, this forging into the future in this dynamic, new, enlightened city, but still with one eye on the past, on the folklore, on the kind of supernatural. And, you know, as a man very much created by the Enlightenment, he is more than any of the other Enlightenment writers in the early 19th century, still haunted by the idea of something supernatural.
He's also a real example of the astonishing way in which these people seem to have grown up. I mean, he's born in the 1770s. And if you look at the other people born around those period, Coleridge or a little bit later, Byron, or even 20 years earlier, Nelson or Wordsworth, they all have these very, very similar lives. They grow up in these chaotic, huge families, except for Byron, all of them on the edge of genteel poverty, staggering on the edge of debt, hoping that they're slightly grander than they really are, often enormous cruelty from their elder brothers or in the schoolroom or from their schoolmates, often running away to hide in the landscape where their first sort of romantic yearnings are discovered as young children hiding under bridges, trying to get away from the sort of brutal brother or the brutal bully in the schoolyard. And all of them with a captain who's a seafarer and letters coming in from India. And that sense, which actually goes right the way through their lives, because in many cases they themselves then end up in debt themselves, this terrible sense of the sort of British middle class teetering on the edge of financial catastrophe and death. I mean, Scott is one of, I think, 12 of whom he's almost the only survivor by the time he's about 45.
Yes, and I mean, he's terribly affected by the deaths of his older brothers, particularly because they had all gone into the army and he desperately wanted to be a soldier. If he could have had one wish, it would have been to be strong enough and fit enough that he could have gone into the army. It was the only thing he really wanted to do. He has a very lovely line about it where he says, "It is better to do things worthy of being written about than just write things worthy to be read."
But he's not a chaotic romantic. He's actually quite a respectable man in the end. I mean, he doesn't particularly, unlike Byron, sleep with his sister or run up huge amounts of debts and gambling rings. He doesn't, as far as I know, cheat on his wife particularly.
He was incredibly faithful, even when you can read between the lines of some of the letters and realise that the relationship wasn't always the happiest.
This is BBC Radio 4 and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, the MP Rory Stewart, is championing the life of the novelist Sir Walter Scott with the expert help of Stuart Kelly. You said that he became, by the standards of poets and writers of his day, a relatively respectable man and quite right-wing towards the end, but he didn't start as a conservative, did he?
Well, this is a bit unclear. I mean, he certainly was more conservative in his way than Wordsworth, but he adopts a relatively conservative position quite soon.
He does. I mean, he is a conservative. He is always cautious about implementing change. He's almost reactionary towards the end of his life. I mean, he was massively opposed to the Reform Bill in 1832, and his friend James Hogg said that the passing of the Reform Bill, that's what killed Scott. He just didn't want to live in a world where they were increasing the franchise that way. I mean, he had a plan to kidnap Princess Victoria. If the Reform Bill passed, the only way to save the country was to kidnap Victoria, hide her in Glamis, and make Wellington the dictator for a few years.
It's going to happen to you, Rory. I mean, you actually started as a youthful socialist and then moved gradually to the right. Are you going to become
crazy reactionary? Mad and bad, trying to kidnap the heir apparent.
Have you sensed yourself moving to the right over the last 20 years?
I think what I have done, which is actually difficult and embarrassing, and I think does relate a little bit to what makes people uncomfortable with Scott, is I think I have begun to see the attraction of lost causes. And I rebelled, for example, against the abolition of the House of Lords in Parliament. And I do feel all the time that, yes, basically things are getting better. With that, I agree with Scott. History's moving forward. But there is terrible, terrible loss along the way. And the past is not like the present. And there were ways in which the past was better than today. Even though in the end, like Scott, I'd much rather live today than I would like to live 200 years ago.
Certainly, I think one of the reasons that Scott is so misprized in Scotland at the moment is he is seen as being a Tory, and Tory now in Scotland doesn't seem to mean conservative, it seems to mean Thatcherite. And there's no way that you could think of Scott in any way as a Thatcherite writer. He has a great sense of paternalism. He has a sense of the duties. There's a beautiful phrase which the Irish writer Maria Edgeworth writes about Scott, where she's comparing him to Dean Swift and says, "Swift wanted to be a lord so that people would treat him as they should treat a lord. And Scott wanted to be a lord so he could treat people as a lord should." And I think it's that old sense of Toryism which is still very valuable in Scott.
What would his advice be, do you think, Rory, to the Scottish Conservative Party? Conservatism, at least with a capital C, has fallen on very lean times in Scotland. How would Scott see that?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that Scott's advice would be the alternative to Scottish independence is not a bland British identity. The alternative to Scottish independence is to be deeply, deeply proud of being Scottish, and that you can be rude about the English and compete with the English, but still wish to be part of the United Kingdom. My father, who is a sort of Walter Scott character and is swathed in tartan and perpetually eating haggis, does so largely to annoy the English, and it would be no fun for him if the United Kingdom was broken up. He wouldn't have any incentive to continue with this kind of behaviour. So I think Scott's advice would be find a way of celebrating being Scottish and take on the fact that Scottish nationalism has decided to be ahistorical. Where Scott would be so brilliant is picking apart the two big problems with Scottish nationalism. The first problem is the Braveheart problem, which he would take to pieces brilliantly, which is an incredibly simplified, peculiar version of Scottish history. And the second is the version that says Scottish independence is all about building wind turbines and we don't think about the past. He'd say, for goodness sake, national identity has to be about history.
Yes, but come, Braveheart, all right, fairly shallow and a distortion or an invention of what really happened in the past, but can't you accuse Scott of being a slightly grander-sounding Braveheart, inventing a past that never quite was, an ability that never quite was?
I think he's much, much better than that, and partly because he's so footnoted, he's so precise with his historical documents. So, for example, you might think that he's a man who sort of romanticises the borders, but he suddenly will put in a footnote, I just came across one recently, where he quotes a French officer. "I myself," says the officer, "sold them a prisoner for a small horse. They laid him down upon the ground, galloped over him with their lances in rest, and wounded him as they passed. When slain, they cut his body in pieces and bore the mangled gobbets in triumph on the points of their spears. I cannot greatly praise the Scottish for this practice." See, he's a man who's perpetually ramming reality into history.
I think the Scottish novels are far more historically accurate. The ones where he's dealing with living memory and the memory of his grandparents' generation, they are far more accurate and far more self-aware than when he starts doing books like Ivanhoe. And even when he does Ivanhoe, he's aware of this himself. He says, you know, beforehand it used to be hearing the whispers of the past. Now it's necromancy. It's bringing the dead to life.
Here is Mark Twain on Walter Scott. "Then comes Sir Walter Scott with his enchantments, who sets the world in love with dreams and phantoms, with decayed and swinish forms of religion, with decayed and degrading systems of government, with the sillinesses and emptinesses, sham grandeurs, sham gauds and sham chivalries of a brainless and worthless long-vanished society. He did measureless harm, more real and lasting harm perhaps than any other individual that ever wrote."
There speaks the American. And that's what's so extraordinary about that.
I'm with him.
I think with Twain, the real target is the South. He was convinced that it was the South which had adopted particular kinds of chivalric behaviour which allowed them to gloss over the inhumanity that this chivalry was founded on. And whenever he talks about Scott, the real target is the South. And there is some rather interesting evidence that when Twain famously said it was because of Scott that the South lost the Civil War, that more officers died because they were charging from the front, whereas the Northern commanders were quite happy to sit behind their cannon and just shell down. So in a way, Twain was onto something quite accurate about the way that the South in particular did it. If there was a great Scott work not by Scott, it's probably gone with the wind.
Rory, you and Penrith and the Borders seem to have adopted each other, but when interviewing for a parliamentary candidature, I seem to remember that you nearly landed Bracknell. Now, could you, or indeed Scott, have fired the romantic imagination of Berkshire, for instance? I'm half serious here. Doesn't the romanticism actually come from the individual and then is pasted onto wherever the individual finds himself?
I'm sure that's right. And I'm sure one would have found a romance in Bracknell and the idea of the new town and Bracknell Squares. But I think it would be a little bit more difficult. I mean, I'm very, very lucky. I have the largest constituency in England. I'm going to spend my entire summer recess walking in Cumbria and along the borders. And it is extraordinary to be able to be in a landscape which is quite so beautiful and where the history is quite so stark and present.
We should keep, I suppose, some kind of grip on the broad outlines of his life. The poetry came first, the ballads came first. And how was he earning his living at this time?
He had studied law.
Yeah.
He had become a writer to the court and had eventually got the sheriffship, the deputy sheriffship, in the Borders, which is when he moves out of Edinburgh and into the Borders. He gets the first ever advance that we know of in publishing. The Lay of the Last Minstrel was so successful that he was offered money sight unseen for whatever he did next. And this is the beginning of the advance culture. And it was a huge amount of money. It was 1,000 guineas. Nobody had commanded sums like this. Scott was very clear about why he gave up poetry. He said, "Byron was better than me."
I think one thing that is troubling for me reading Scott is also his limitations, his weaknesses. the sadness of the fact that he's forgotten partly reflects the fact that there's something wrong. And what's wrong is that he never quite becomes Scotland's Goethe. He comes out of the Scottish Enlightenment, second generation Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, but he never really takes on political economy, he never really takes on natural science. That incredible Scottish achievement, that intellectual achievement, somehow isn't fully integrated into him as a historian. The only way in which I feel frustrated with him is that if he'd been a little bit more intellectually curious and interested in academic thought, then he would have survived and presented a very different vision of Scotland, which perhaps would have left the Scottish nationalists in more trouble than they now are in their ability to dismiss him.
He became, didn't he, Stuart, a bit of a courtier as well?
Yes, he was offered the poet laureateship.
Yeah.
In one of those moments of nobility which his life is full of, he turned down the laureateship because he didn't want to have to write to queue on order. But also he said that he already had a number of government positions as a sheriff, and poor Robert Southey had none, so please give him the laureateship instead. He kept a very close eye on the proceedings. He was very close to George IV. I mean, he even refers to him as my fat friend, which very few people could get away with.
Rory, you too have had little brushes with royalty. Didn't you tutor one of the princes for a little while?
I did.
What's the attraction? What's the magic of it? Presumably the young man is no more or less interesting than any other young man.
I guess on that one, Matthew, I'm perhaps less confident than Scott in making comments about royalty. But he's also, I think, the other thing that you're maybe perhaps missing, Matthew, if I was going to challenge him on portraying him as a sort of pompous ass, is that actually he's very, very funny. I mean, for example, in his journal, he says, this is just him writing in his diary, he says, almost sick with pain, and it stops everything. I shall tire of my journal if it is to contain nothing but bile and piles and plastures and unguents. My pains were months of the heart, but still the colon has his rights. As Jeffreys said, whether we board a barrack smack or take the mail or mount a hack, none leaves his arse behind.
If only he'd written like that in his novels. I don't know why.
In a way, there's something very, very important about that, Matthew. He couldn't write in the novels. These were public documents. It is the very privacy of the journal that allows him that space.
I mean, No. The best writers allow that privacy to invade in some way their public thoughts. And if you can't do it, that's a shortcoming as a writer.
That slight primness, in the end, prevents him from being a lasting world historical figure. We need to sort of take off the primness, get back to what makes him wild, magnificent, peculiar in the nature of his imagination, and draw Scotland's strength from that.
My thanks to Rory Stewart, MP, for championing the great life of Walter Scott, and to our expert witness, Stuart Kelly. Goodbye.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this Great Lives podcast. Many other BBC programmes are available as podcasts. You can find details at bbc.co.uk/radio4.